Guys, we're in the middle of the pandemic, and these are trying times. It's hard on our mental health, our mental state, and this is why I love our sponsor today, BetterHelp. They're the largest online counseling platform worldwide. They change the way people get help with facing life's challenges by providing convenient, discreet, affordable access to licensed therapists. BetterHelp makes professional counseling available anytime, anywhere, through a computer, tablet, or smartphone. It's brilliant. Sign up today. Go to betterhelp.com/solvinghealthcare and get 10% off sign-up fees.
COVID has affected us all, and with all the negativity surrounding it, it's often hard to find the positive. One of the blessings it has given us is the opportunity to build an avenue for creating change, starting right here in our community. Discussing topics that affect us most, such as racism in healthcare, maintaining a positive mindset, creating change, the importance of advocacy, and the many lessons we have all learned from COVID. If you or your organization are interested in speaking engagements, send a message to quadcast99@gmail.com, reach out on Facebook at Quadcast, or online at drquadjo.ca.
Welcome to Solving Healthcare. I'm Quadjo Caramante. I'm an ICU and palliative care physician here in Ottawa and the founder of Resource Optimization Network. We are on a mission to transform healthcare in Canada. I'm going to talk with physicians, nurses, administrators, patients and their families because inefficiencies, overwork, and overcrowding affects us all. I believe it's time for a better healthcare system that's more cost-effective, dignified, and just for everyone involved. Welcome, Quadcast Nation. It's been a while since we've done a live episode, but listen, the time is ripe. There's a lot of dynamic things happening in the world of COVID, so we had to get the experts. We had to get the infectious disease specialists that you know are only the best. We got Sumana Chakrabarty. We got Monica Gandhi. They need no introduction. But so, number one, thank you for joining. Two, let's get some of the housekeeping things out of the way. Healthcare providers, Solving Wellness, our latest initiative to try and reduce burnout within healthcare. We got online workouts, online yoga, cooking classes, nutrition tips, mindful meditation, an online community. We're at 200 members plus, and it's been great. It's been great to be able to connect together, tell our stories. And so sign up today. You're going to have the lovely Julia will put the link below. And if you sign up for our newsletter, if you press NL into the chat box, you'll have a chance to get a free membership. You know what I'm saying? Free membership, because like we always say, we're trying to change the boogie over here on Solving Healthcare, Solving Wellness. Third thing, just want to give some props and some love. Julia Ajars will be fielding our questions so that we could navigate through that. She's got a great website, A Spoonful of Science, getting notoriety, you know, all throughout the nation. So I just want to say a special thank you to Julia. And last but not least, gotta love your Solving Healthcare merchandise. Go to solvinghealthcare.ca. Look at this. Look at this fantabulousness. Oh my gracious. Yes. So once again, Dr. Chakrabarty, Dr. Gandhi, welcome to the show. I am excited to be talking about all these things. And I think first we'll start with Monica. And I think the easy one to get out of the way is this booster talk. A lot of people are wondering, what does this mean? You know, they're seeing this data coming out of Israel saying, like, is this vaccine actually working? Why are we needing a booster? Who should get the booster? How many boosters are going to be in the future? What are your thoughts on this topic?
Well, you know, when Biden actually announced that we should all get boosters, I was actually almost fell on the floor. I was really surprised because it just seemed like the vaccines not only were working really well in terms of, you know, why you would develop a vaccine, because we never developed a vaccine for rhinovirus or adenovirus or cold viruses. We developed it because of protecting against severe disease, and they were working really well. And then also just the immune system, like you get T cells and you get B cells, and then your antibodies will go down, totally normal. But then the B cells are a blueprint to produce more antibodies. And we already had data that you biopsied people's lymph nodes and we got B cells, if you're immunocompetent, from the vaccines. So I was very surprised. And then, yeah, it was really Israel that kept on saying this. And I think there's like so many reasons that Israel's different than certainly Canada and us, but it's only the Pfizer vaccine. They did 3 weeks strictly between doses, which is not the best interval. I think Pfizer, actually, I was just thinking today that it needs to be refrigerated, or I just hope it's not unstable at all, because it's a little, it needs to be kept more cold than Moderna. Then there's mixed populations. It was great at vaccinating, but then went down. I think it's 45th in the world now because mixed populations, lots of many populations in the country haven't gotten vaccinated. They also define severe disease differently, apparently. So people can be at home and they still define that as severe disease. So there were so many things that are different about Israel that I felt like, just like the FDA, I felt like we should be looking at all of the data, especially from your country.
Yeah.
So I was surprised. And I think selected populations, great, fine. Older people, of course, we vaccinate a lot of older people, immunocompromised. But in a general way for everyone, I think that just kind of sowed distrust, like, oh no, are we going to need boosters forever? It was really depressing.
Yeah. Thanks for that. So Suman, what were your thoughts in terms of hearing talks of booster, and like who you think needs boosters, who you think doesn't need boosters, based on the data that we know today?
I agree with Monica, what she was mentioning about, the actual science aspect of it. And I think that one thing that I thought was interesting is just how the narrative kind of unfolded. I think that I like the thing that just in talking to people in the public, people were always worried about something happening that was going to kind of pull the rug out from under us at the 11th hour. So like, you know, we had this amazing vaccine. Just kidding, it doesn't work, something like that, right? So, you know, we were hearing about antibodies waning at 6 months, and we were all like, yeah, we know that that happens. But then all of a sudden, that kind of took a story that, oh, wait a minute, your antibodies are waning. And then that kind of morphed into this story that maybe the immunity is waning. And then we saw like the same graph that we all saw, this graph on Twitter, where they kind of showed the efficacy after a certain amount of time against infection, against symptomatic COVID. And then the last part of it was severe disease and hospitalization. So our eyes all went to the right side. Oh, this is awesome. It's showing that against severe disease, it still works. But then everybody focused on the left side. And then this story kind of just spun. And as I was describing, I think that Israel was like laxative for the world's pants. Like everybody just like shat their pants when they saw this. And then we got here. And I think that I agree that like boosters might help in certain populations, or I guess technically it would be a third dose, right? Dose in that series. But you know, for everybody, I agree. It just sows distrust, and I don't think we need it.
Yeah.
One other thing I want to say about Israel, though, I really thought about this a lot, that they had a 3.8 seroprevalence rate in September. There was a study that was done. They have very low rates of natural immunity, and other places like the UK and the US have much higher rates of natural immunity. And California has a lot because we had a terrible third surge in the winter. And I'm wondering what also that mixture of natural and vaccine immunity, yeah, is. And maybe you need three shots if you've never been exposed, like Australia and New Zealand. They're gonna take a while to get to immunity, right?
Wow, there's a lot of good points here that I gotta highlight. So one, on Monica's first point about like combating like your general immune system. So it's not clear to me, and don't let me put words in y'all's mouth, but because you have a delayed antibodies or low antibodies titers, for example, because you have memory B cells, because you have T cells, it doesn't mean that you cannot combat severe disease. And in fact, I saw a paper, I can't remember where it was, but looking at even SARS-CoV-1, that they had memory T cell, or the T cell response 17 years after the fact was present. Right. So
that was 2003, and then 2020, yeah, they found people still have memory T cells. Yeah,
absolutely. So like no reason to think that would wane. I think that needs to be highlighted. And then in terms of like, I just want to really highlight too, that that, you know, the people that were thinking about that third dose, it's those that might be immunocompromised, those that might have a difficulty mounting an immune response, or our elderly population. Like, these are the folks that you're really thinking about it. Cause I have, you know, people our age coming up to me saying, do I need that third dose? And, you know, I'm a bit shocked at how, strong of a force this has become, and saying, hey, yeah, maybe I'm going to be seeking out my third dose. And some people actually were telling me, because of, I hate to say this, but like travel purposes, because they were mixed, which is such, oh my God.
I mean, we haven't even mentioned the kind of global implications of not giving other people their first dose. Right. When we're talking about third doses here, I mean, I think the best way that someone put it to me is, we want Americans not to get a cold, but we are going to not give out some of our dose, more of our doses that we promised to resource limited settings. So that's that kind of moral failing. And I know that you guys have been thinking a lot about, is really difficult to contemplate.
Yeah. And maybe even Suman commenting on like why it's important, like black and white, like why the rest of the world needing to be getting that first dose, not only for survival, but what are the other implications?
Well, I mean, you know, if you look, obviously variants, when they were kind of rapidly, we were still seeing them, obviously, but like getting the rest of the world under control is just going to, first of all, help people in areas. I think it's hard for us to comprehend, even in places like Russia, where, you know, Sputnik kind of didn't kind of live up to what it was, but people, like 1,000 people are dying a day. I think the issue for us is that you get those places, all the places in the world under control, it helps humankind, it decreases ongoing replication, transmission slash the likelihood of another variant coming up. So I think that it's almost like, how can I explain this? Being benevolent for the rest of the world actually also helps us too, right?
Yeah,
so
abandon the moral ethical argument if you want to do that, but if there's a public health argument for, totally, giving doses to the world,
100%. Yeah. And as you mentioned, Monica, this is what's hard to hear, you know, this talk about third doses, when we could be globally improving the situation for all of us, not just ourselves. And I'll be remiss to glaze over the point about Monica talking about natural immunity and its impact on waves. And there's been a lot of talk. I don't know if it's been Twitter. My head's been in the clouds a little bit here, but like, there's a lot of people questioning, is natural immunity a thing? Is it going to be as strong as getting a vaccine? And I'm going to say this, because I have to say this, even though it's common sense, by no means am I saying that natural immunity is strong, I'm telling people to go get COVID. I'm just saying those that have gotten it to acknowledge that what their risk factors of getting reinfected or of getting severe disease. So maybe we'll start with Monica. What are your thoughts on the impact of having a natural COVID infection and or duration of being safe?
Yes, I mean, I think there's two ways to think about it. One is that your natural infection varied. There's a whole bunch of natural infections, really mild, really severe. And I think that the reason that the data is mixed, because we can't say that the data isn't mixed. Some data shows that more reinfection after natural infection, more reinfection after vaccination, is because the original infection is mixed. Like if you had a more severe infection, you're more likely to produce deep B cells and T cells. And if you had a very mild natural infection, maybe you need that vaccine. And then on the other hand, so is the data of vaccination mixed. Going back to Israel, if you give it every 3 weeks, you know, which like you guys really proved, like that we needed longer time between doses, not like you proved it, like frankly, that's a principle of vaccinology, but Canada really took it to heart. And also you were trying to save more lives, which was a great approach. You now just like 4 days ago showed data from, I think your national network showed that if you give it 3 weeks apart, like in healthcare workers, it was 82% effective. And then up to 7 weeks apart, it was 92% effective. Already was 10% more effective than Pfizer. So Israel is like the worst of all comparisons, because they don't have a lot of natural infection. Maybe people who got naturally infected were sick. And then you give the vaccine in the worst way possible, which is 3 weeks apart. And so, of course, that one study that showed that you're much more protected after natural infection, like 27 times more protected against natural infection, was only from Israel. So we can't just look at that. It seems like it's back and forth, and it depends on your initial severity of infection and how the vaccine was administered. But of course, natural immunity is a thing. It's so silly to say it's not a thing that it's really irritating people.
Mm. Anything to add, Sumar?
Yeah, and again, so like I said, like this, the scientific aspect of it is way better than I ever could. And one thing I'll add to this is that, what I called when Trump was president, the Trump effect or the anti-vax effect, is that sometimes somebody will say something like that, and then it's basically the other people just put a negative sign in front of it. So it's like, if Trump said something, then it's automatically wrong. If the anti-vax movement says natural immunity is good, then it's obviously bad. And I think that clearly that black and white thinking doesn't help. Okay. Of course, natural immunity, let's call it post-infectious immunity. Let's take away the lightning charge from the term, right? Post-infectious immunity is clearly a thing. And I think that in line with what you were saying, Monica, is if we look at what's happening in Canada or in Ontario right now, I don't have the full explanation, but what I wonder is that if you look at our network of population, especially in GTA, we got destroyed in wave 1, 2, and 3, destroyed. And the people who are unvaccinated, a lot of them have the same overlapping risk as the people who had the risk of getting COVID in the first place. So I suspect there's a significant amount of immunity. There's going to be data coming, but I suspect there's a significant amount of immunity in our unvaccinated populations in like the epicenter. And that's part of the reason why we're seeing a bit of a, have you seen our curve, by the way, Monica? It's crazy. Yeah. It's been like, it's kind of like this, we've been bouncing around, our R's been bouncing around 1 for like several weeks now. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's what's part of what's helping us.
Yeah.
This is a very good point. Cause I mean, one of the things that and maybe I haven't seen this data, and Sumar, correct me if I'm wrong, but I would love for us to do some seroprevalence stuff within Ontario, man. Like to really, and I think it's important for a couple of reasons. One, just to get a sense of like, you know, how really hard hit we've been, see how many just to get a sense of the asymptomatic spread that's happened or limited symptomatic spread, but also like to plan, to like prognosticate. Like if you know that a significant amount of your unvaccinated are like immune. I don't even know what to call it without being controversial.
Immunity is controversial.
Once I said to myself, T cells are not Republican. So, but yeah, go ahead.
That'd be a great t-shirt, by the way.
Yeah.
We'll put that on the list, Julia. It would be great. Like, I think it would be so informative to know, like especially in our unvaccinated population, what their seroprevalence studies look like. Because I agree. I think this is what's been protecting us to a certain degree, Suman, from that fourth wave. Because if you saw some of the projections for our fourth wave, there was one person that said we could, if we're not careful, we could get up to 20,000 ICU admissions, which is unprecedented. But I do think that has been a reason why we've been okay during this wave.
I think Delta killed places that had low natural immunity and low vaccination rates. The ultimate example is India, where it started. And then it had a 4% vaccination rate. And now India has an 18% vaccination rate, but it has very low cases because there's natural immunity there from this terrible Delta, but it didn't kill places that had a lot of high natural immunity and vaccination. So California was better off than Missouri.
Mm. Yeah. And then we'll look even around the world, like Taiwan, Singapore. Yes. Yes. I mean, they got under control, the whole whiplash thing, but like I think that Australia and New Zealand are going to have, they're going to have trouble with their exit waves. They'll get over it.
It'll take them a while. To get through this.
I mean, I'm not one to get a little bit on the controversy side, but these COVID zero people came strong, yo. Like they came strong, like on a political level and on social media, they came that COVID shield. You know what I'm saying? They came hard. And I mean, I know personally, they came after, me personally. I don't know if Suman, you got that heat too, but holy cow. That's one thing that,
it's not realistic.
Yeah. To
do, and that actually can be dangerous in a way, because you're doing everything just about COVID, and then so many other things fall by the wayside.
Yeah. Yeah. The collateral damage. Yeah. So I think one of the things that we'd be hard pressed not to mention then, like when it comes to that like natural immunity, is like mandates. Like one of the things that I think has been interesting is, you know, in most places in Canada now, if not everywhere, there's vaccine mandates, like vaccine passports and certificates. And one of the things that I always found interesting is that we haven't considered their infection risk, or if they've had an infection here, and I think throughout the country. Suman, what any thoughts about one, like the certificates in general, and two, whether you think immunity passport versus vaccine passport should be a consideration?
I think that this is my personal opinion. For me, like, I think we know that in certain areas, mandates help to squeeze last couple of drops of juice out of the lemon, right? You do certainly see in most places when a mandate's put in place, you get this rush of vaccines, people that have been holding out, like in France, we saw it. We didn't see it in Ontario, interestingly, but we saw it in a lot of other provinces. So I guess with my thing is that I like the idea if somebody, because I have a lot of these conversations at work, as part of what I was doing in the last couple of months, is that many of the vaccine hesitant people, I found that in speaking with them and talking about their concerns in a non-judgmental way, I was able to persuade meaning in a good way to get the vaccine. There's ardent anti-vaxxers. Nobody's going to get to them. I get that. And a mandate just kind of makes them dig in, reactants, as we've heard this call. But I think the other thing is, I agree with you on the immunity certificate rather than vaccine, because places in Europe are doing that. And I do think that there are some people that say, look, I've already had vaccination. I've already had COVID, sorry. And I want to get one dose, but they're telling me I have to get two. And there is actually evidence that you get robust protection, COVID, then one dose of vaccine. So they have a point. It's hard to argue against that. And then all of a sudden, the final thing I'll say is the optics of it is, for example, nurses, in the last year and a half, many of us have, you know, risked our lives not knowing when we didn't have PPE, we didn't have vaccines, working in a hospital, giving our time away from our families. And then now, a year and a half later, you're saying, okay, if you don't get vaccinated, we're going to say you can't work here anymore. And it just, to me, it personally doesn't sit well. So that's why I have mixed feelings about it. I understand it needs to be done in certain situations, but it just doesn't sit right.
Monica, anything? How are you feeling about this?
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. And actually, I did write a paper on vaccine mandates, but I should have called it immunity mandates because I said it in the paper itself or in the piece itself at the bottom that let's consider it immunity mandates as opposed to vaccine mandates to enter. I agree with you, though, that there is a reason to get one dose, especially if there's a lot of circulating virus. I mean, even a booster, like if you're surrounded by virus, then it's helpful to get like if you're a respiratory tech or maybe an ICU physician, and you're really intubating with people with COVID, like there is an advantage getting a booster, and the same thing if you've had natural infection, if you're surrounded by virus. But we've really caused some alienation by this vaccine mandates. I should have said immunity mandates, because I think that they managed to figure it out in France and Israel and so many places. You just have documentation that you're immune.
Yeah. You know, something to add to that, I keep hearing this excuse that, oh, you know, if we do that, it's going to be like a bureaucratic mess. Okay. But the thing is, you can do it. You can print out your
2021. I also keep thinking we're 2021 and we designed a really cool vaccine. So it's not that like we can't figure out an app. I don't know. I'm sure we can.
Yeah. I agree.
I got to say too, on a personal level, along the lines of what Suman mentioned, when people come to me and that have been hesitant, there's a huge theme of already having COVID. I personally haven't met too many like 5G people or whatever, like maybe online, but like I don't having that one-on-one conversation with people. It's like I've had COVID, or some people have had. One person I would think about had a poor reaction, had COVID, got their first dose, had a poor reaction, and was really scared of having a second dose. And yeah, like when we think about, you know, the dedication that a lot of the staff had, and also the manpower issues that we're having within healthcare right now, I think a lot of it would be alleviated if you acknowledge that their initial infection. And, cause like most people, as usual, are totally reasonable. Like everyone assumes that when you hear that conversation that they're hesitant, that it's like some extreme view. And the last thing I'll also say is like, at least in the hospitals that I work at, luckily this is an extreme minority, by the way. Like for us, it's like not like on a percentage, it's from the docs, from the nurses. It's been unbelievable pickup for the reception for the vaccine. So I'm hoping that's the norm in a lot of places. But
estimated 96% of doctors have gotten the vaccine, which I use when I tell people, like, if people are concerned about it being safe, they say, well, but this is such a high percentage of doctors have gotten
it. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So one of the hottest topics du jour is vaccinating our 5 to 11 year olds. That was by far the most questions that we were seeing when we reached out to the public in Quadcast Nation, saying like, what are you guys thinking about in terms of the 5 to 11 year olds? And maybe we'll start with Monica. Like, any consideration? So a lot of the questions were based on risk benefit ratio. Like, you know, knowing that the 5 to 11 year olds are low risk, knowing that we've evaluated roughly 1,100 to 1,200 doses were given to that age bracket. Is there maybe any initial thoughts when you think about that demographic in terms of vaccinating them?
You know, before without Delta, I actually thought we could get there without vaccinating them. Like, we could protect the unvaccinated by vaccinating everyone else, and especially not children who really have low risk of severe disease. And we live in a very different country than you do, but we didn't get the high rates of vaccination that we needed out of adults, way more, less than so many other developed countries. And that means that vaccinating more and more people is a good thing. I also think that children grow up, and I also think, and they can get risk for severe disease later. And I also think that it prevents, it protects others, it protects adults, it protects their grandparents. And so I think about the 5 mandated vaccines, there's 7 mandated vaccines in this country: pertussis, diphtheria, mumps, measles, rubella. And then there's also pneumococcus and H flu. And pneumococcus and H flu are not really high risk for children, but they really brought down rates in adults when we gave children the pneumococcal vaccine. So of course, something has to be totally safe in this population to justify it, right? Because we're kind of saying, children, you get vaccinated to protect others, it has to be really safe. And I think the safety of the vaccine depends on dose. And I also think it depends on spacing. And I was gratified that the FDA said, hey, we're seeing some 30 micrograms may have been a little too high for a 12-year-old, so we're going to make this 10. And the FDA told Pfizer to do that. They told Pfizer to reduce the dose. Pfizer was going to study 5, 10, and 20s in this younger. And then they were, and they were quietly told, you know what, let's just do, lower, because we can't have any side effects. There really should be a very major risk versus benefit if you're going to ask essentially children to get vaccinated to protect others. So I will tell you that I can just tell you as a personal thing, I have an 11-year-old and I have a 13-year-old. So I really have that decision in front of me. And I fortunately am, it's just me making the decision. And I vaccinated the 13-year-old, but I extended the interval between doses because I was looking at Canada. And I know vaccinology and I know it's more effective to extend, but I also saw more myocarditis in Israel. I saw it reported out of Israel. I keep on thinking, what's different about Israel? 3 weeks. And so I deliberately did that thinking it'd be more safe. And the 11-year-old, I will vaccinate with the 10, but I will extend duration between his doses. And my pediatrician has already said that she's going to tell all of the, her parents that. So I think it's really fine, and they do grow up.
That is actually a point that hadn't registered actually for me, was the point about what's different about Israel and that interval. It's a very good point.
I can't get over the second dose.
It really is that second dose.
It is that second dose in young males. And I have two males. And I was not going to do what Israel did. And so I extended it. But it's also more effective. You guys proved that. You know how much I admire Canada for like extending the duration. It wasn't just that you did it. You saved more lives by giving out more first doses.
What are your thoughts, Suman? You got how old's your youngest now? 4.
Yeah, so she's turning 4. So yeah, okay. I just have a year for that decision. So oldest is turning 4 in December. Youngest is 2. Well, youngest is technically 0. We're going to be in December, but I've been struggling.
Congratulations!
Thank you. It's been a pandemic, right?
And yeah, you're the father.
We'll see. But you know, I think that I am really struggling with this. So first of all, I would say that whatever decision, I haven't made one yet. I'm not steadfast in any way, but I am struggling with this. And I think that part of what has kind of started me struggling on this is the fact I can already hear, I've heard our officer of health for the city talking about already mandating the vaccine. Like really, a couple of things that are concerning for me, exactly what Monica mentioned. Number one, you know, when you look at the vaccine, you want to look at it for personal risk and for transmission risk, right? So the first one is for personal risk. Yeah, the kids, I know what people say. I know there were parts of the states that got pretty wrecked. But in Canada, we had a we didn't get a lot of severe cases. So then you have to have something that's extremely safe if you're going to use it for transmission. The question that I have, you know, are kids really all that epidemiologically significant for that way transmission? Of course, kids can transmit, but the overwhelming transmission happens to them as opposed to from them, right? Okay, fair enough. So, and then you talk about the risk of COVID causing myocarditis, and that's there too. So I think that the risk benefit is what I'm struggling with. And let's say Canada is different in this regard. Let's say if we get to a point where we have a very, very high amount of vaccine immunity in the community, right? You're already seeing cases drop. Then I have less of desire to want to vaccinate the kids. I don't think you need to in that regard. Maybe you can you make it optional? Sure. But I think that the regionality does matter here. What's happening in your situation. I think in Ontario, just pretend if this is how Ontario is going to be. We now have, you know, pretty low transmission rate. We have pretty good immunity level. I can't see a reason to do it. Denmark didn't do it, right? So that's where I'm at. I'm still, my opinion is still evolving as more evidence comes in.
I mean, these are all great points. And for me, it's, I'm along the same lines. I got three boys, and I do want to see the number. Like part of my concern is, you know, when you have 1100 to 1200 kids evaluated, it's hard to really find that safety signal based on the previous, you know, our previous rollout with the vaccine, like the VIT. We saw later on, not in the initial studies, the myocarditis weren't, we didn't see in the initial studies. And in our current state in Ontario, I agree with Suman, like the kids are really low risk. And so I'm not saying no, to me, it's like, I want to see more, my personal standpoint is I would want to see more data. But this is a tough one. It really is a tough one. And it's my fear, based on the way we've seen things, is that it's going to be mandated.
I would really like to mention one thing about that is we have done a lot with children in this pandemic to limit them as human beings and their usual childhoods because of protecting adults or the concern about protecting adults, like closed schools for long periods of time and have children in masks. And anything that you do, there has to be a promise that we allow children to go back to their normalcy, because it's really interesting. California is the most restrictive place for children in the country. We've 50 out of 50 in terms of opening schools, finally did it this year because the overwhelming effects of school closures were so obvious. And we've talked about this before on this call, but there's no promise that anything's going to go back to normal for children after the governor said that he's going to mandate 12 to 15 year olds to be vaccinated. There was no promise, but yes, then they don't have to wear masks. Like, there seems to be, like, children are just curtailed at all points in this pandemic.
Oh my goodness. It's, I mean, just at a personal level, I'll just say especially my first two children, actually all three, when you saw the impact of them having to be not at school and just that lack of social connection, all these things were directly impacted. It was heartbreaking. And to see their eyes and their smiles when they got to connect with their kids again was just so, like, it makes me well up a little bit thinking about how meaningful it was. Second point I want to make in terms of, you know, when it comes to, like, if we're going to convince people, we do have to show them that their efforts are going to lead to something. Like, I was on a call today and I was doing my walk-in call and I saw kids, high school kids that, by the way, the vaccination rates in Ontario for the 12 and ups is unbelievable, especially in my city, Ottawa. But they're playing football, not even soccer, sorry, with masks on. Like 16-year-old kids playing
outside.
You know what I mean? I'm like, guys, like, we got to adapt, yo. Like, you know, give the kids something. They've all stepped up. We've asked them to step up, and they did step up. And now you're still having the high levels of restriction. And, you know, to me, it's a hard pill to swallow when they've all done, so many of them have done the right thing.
Let alone the learning loss and just like the racial inequities in our country on learning loss. But we all feel the same way about schools.
But man, I really like that point though. I don't know if I've really thought about that before. I don't know if it was on yours, radar, Suman, about the interval and the myocarditis. I was just thinking.
No, I agree. It was a really good point. And the question is that we really have to put that into context when interpreting all data, right? I think it's very, very important.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Absolutely.
But it's interesting. Monica mentioned something that it also resonated. This is something that is a principle of vaccinology, right? Like, you know, I remember when we were talking about spreading the interval, you know, we were trying to yelling that, oh, you're half vaccinated, you're killing people. You know, I used to say, well, look at hepatitis A. The second dose can be given at 6 to 36 months, right? It's the way that B cells mature. But the point is that these really kind of important bedrock principles were being thrown out the window.
There is no vaccine in the world that you give 3 weeks apart. And I think that Moderna is actually working better than Pfizer for a couple of reasons. One is it's a higher dose, but I also think it's even 4 weeks is better than 3 weeks.
Even
one more week, because there is not a vaccine in the world that you give 3 weeks apart. So just because the clinical trials were rushed, which is understandable, they were going fast, they wanted to get this out, doesn't mean you can't think and say, okay, I'm going to advise for my country longer than 3 weeks. And that's why, so many people asked the US to do the same thing and they didn't.
Can I just give a little plug? I know Henry's been under fire lately, but like, holy cow, like what a courageous play. Like she was one of the, at least from my viewpoint, saying like,
I don't even know her and I admire this person.
Yeah, she's a BC. A BC public health.
I know. Every time you talk about her, I'm like, this is a reasonable human being.
Oh, she's fantastic.
And health and officer who thought about children, who thought about spaces.
Yes. And just like she was a hardcore advocate about extending the doses between like the interval of doses. Like, well, one of the most vocal ones about it and was, you know, did it at the forefront. And also,
you told me before that she understood outside is so much safer than inside. So
yeah,
anything absolutely. You do to close the outside is crazy. And everything you want to do is encourage outside
with
this virus. Yeah.
The most, out of all of them, just the most like common sense approach. And she took a lot of heat, as you mentioned, as Suman was mentioning. They're like, oh, you could be killing people, all this kind of attitude. And she was queen bee again. She was like, yes, this is truth. And it's great to hear it. And I just I would love to meet her one day just to give her a big hug, because holy cow, does she take sauce, man. She gets it all sides, and I just admire her overall approach. Last thing before maybe taking a few questions was, how do you see this? How do we see this ending? How do we see this playing out? Because, like, I'm going to start with Suman, because, like, I'm going to pick on our the situation in Ontario, because there was a lot of talk about us, like people, there was a lot of projection saying that we'd be worse in our third wave. And, you know, I'm not saying we're out of the woods yet. It's, you know, October 14th. Who knows what the next, you know, I've learned not to predict things. Like, how do we see this ending? Like, or are we all constantly going to be in this state of, like, you know, some form of restrictions? Where do you see this playing out?
Yeah, I agree with you that, you know, first of all, the fourth wave for us, the blunted plateau was a very, very pleasant surprise. And, you know, I think it's important for us to try to understand, see what happened here. I think that I agree with everyone. We have to be careful about, you know, premature celebrations, because the winter is coming up. So I think that's a reasonable thing. My feeling is that, you know, with SARS-1, especially in Toronto, it was something that, even though there wasn't a set end, there was a time where, look, we haven't had any cases in whatever it was, 14 days, we're done, we're ready. Although that didn't pan out the first time, the second time it did. But the point is, then there was a party, there was that SARS stock or whatever. I think here it's not going to be, it's going to kind of whimper out in certain areas. And I think what is important, it's not going to all happen at once in different parts of the world, right? It's going to kind of happen all over. So it's going to be a very kind of slow transition period. And I think people are going to still, like, you know, when there's going to be a day, it's hard to believe that mask mandates will probably drop in Peel. Monica, we're in an area called Peel. It's like one of the hardest hit areas in Canada. So Peel, the mask mandate will drop. And I think people will still wear masks. People are still going to be scared for a while. And then eventually it'll kind of, just like it did with SARS. That's what I think. But it's not like a one event. It's going to be like a slow fade.
How about you, Monica? What are you thinking? Like, you could speak locally if that's easier, just because that's a pretty broad question. But
well, I mean, it's an amazingly good question, because people I can see in the chat are asking about Denmark. I mean, let's just admit it. So Denmark on September 10th dropped everything, dropped all restrictions. They had a 74% vaccination rate. They had some natural immunity. They didn't vaccinate children, and they stopped. They stopped everything, masks, everything. And it's been now a month and change, and they haven't seen increasing hospitalizations. Cases, if you swab a lot of people, will go up, but the hospitalizations have not gone up. Deaths have not gone up. Looks like they're accepting where they are, which the accepting of endemicity. What does endemicity mean? It means that the virus is still around, but it's not causing severe illness. It's not causing a lot of hospitalizations, and you live with it. And I know someone's going to ask about molnupiravir, and we could talk about that, but like, you have a treatment, which is molnupiravir, which is going to come. You have vaccination, which I hope everyone will get a lot more of in the United States. And you have prevention and treatment. And then it's like pertussis. It's whooping cough. It's called, it's under control. It has whooping cough, has azithromycin, and then it has a vaccine. And then where will we see COVID? We'll see it in people who decline to vaccinate. So groups, you know, like communities that say there'll be an outbreak here because they didn't vaccinate. And we'll see some breakthroughs, and we may have a treatment now. And it's going to fizzle, like you said. And it's a country's decision to accept that it's going to still be with you, but that it's not causing a burden and that you can open. And many countries, Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Portugal, Italy, I mean, are approaching that point.
I got to say, I don't know where we are in the trajectory here, but it's exciting to see countries successfully so far moving forward. It just gives hope to everybody that all their efforts.
Immunity is the only way to get through a pandemic. Yeah. I will never think that masking, distancing, ventilation testing, contact tracing are anything but tools. Immunity is the way to get to normal life.
That is very well put. That's a great way to frame it.
Dr. Gandhi, wasn't it you that said that immunity will protect you better than a mask ever could? I like that line.
Anyone who says that a mask is better than a vaccine, I mean, not these vaccines. So yeah, that really sucks. That's a stupid thing to say.
No, thank you.
Vaccines are, I mean, immunity is what gets you to normal life. It's always gotten us back to normal life. For anything where you either have a vaccine for or the infection, unfortunately, in case of HIV, of course, attacks your own immune system. But otherwise, anything else, a vaccine, immunity has always gotten us back to normal.
Amazing.
And yes, people can wear masks for the next 2 years. I mean, that's normal behavior. Like, that's totally it's up to everyone. But a mandate can't be imposed. It has to be a personal choice.
Agreed. Okay, so we're going to take the next 10 minutes to answer a few questions. Those that are just that have signed up late, you press NL into your chat box. You'll get not only our newsletter, you'll get sent to you this episode, the podcast and the video, and a chance to get a Solving Wellness membership. Check it. Okay. First question, I think that is okay. And I'm going to start with Monica on this one. Why are vaccinated college and university students not in class? Why are they not in class despite,
this really worries me, actually, in the sense that if there are universities, many have mandated the vaccine, and so you essentially have a 99% vaccinated community. If you can't let them go back to normal, then what hope do we have for like entering normalcy? So Denmark has decided at 74%, 88% over 18 is vaccinated to go back to normal. And then these college campuses are not letting them unmask, and they're doing a lot of asymptomatic testing, and they're not in lecture halls, and they can't even. So we have to model normalcy in highly vaccinated places.
Do you have thoughts on maybe asymptomatic testing in that context, or if you want to do, or more broadly?
I mean, actually, the CDC does not even recommend fully vaccinated people who are feeling well to be tested. So I don't know what this asymptomatic screening is of fully vaccinated people is, but it may reveal a little bit of virus in your nose because you just killed it because you're super, you have a great immune system, you just killed it because you have a vaccine, and then it's in your nose, and then you have to suddenly stay home for 14 days. It's very strange. So yeah, I mean, this is these college campuses are worrying me.
Agreed. I mean, just at a high level, I just think it's
young people have really been not had the best time during this pandemic.
Yeah. All right, Suman, or you could defer this one. Yeah. Do you have thoughts on
Thor's hammer?
Molnupiravir. I can't say it. Can you say it for me?
Molnupiravir. Yeah, it's named after Mjolnir. I actually used to read the Marvel stuff, Thor's hammer. Anyway,
I used to play sports.
I learned about this initially from Monica talking about, I think it was on Z-Dog's podcast. And cool, what is this? There's one thing that I thought, first of all, I hate when people start talking about game changes and stuff like that. I think it's a game helper, right? You have something that can be, it's oral, it can be used, it's primarily meant to be used for people who have been exposed, for minor disease, you're trying to prevent hospitalization. I think that's awesome because, we are using, for example, the monoclonals in this context, but it's difficult. You need infrastructure for infusion, which you don't need with molnupiravir. I saw one of my colleagues, Dr. Gerald Evans, he was able to get his hands on some of the data, and apparently, so they were talking about the relative risk reduction was something like 50%, but the absolute risk reduction was a lot smaller. So it wasn't quite as big as it was initially brought up. But that said, I mean, if you have something that's relatively safe, cheap, which is going to be probably a problem, but in an oral way that you can give prior to hospitalization, I think it's something to look into, and it could be a good game helper. Monica, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a little more excited about it than you are, actually, only because I, as an HIV doctor, like, I love the idea of a specific antiviral as opposed to like anything non-specific. So it's really specifically targeted. I mean, again, it's against RNA viruses, polymerases, and it's 5 days and it's outpatient, and it's, you know, hopefully we'll keep people out of the hospital and early. We just don't have an orally available treatment, and we've been going at this for 22 months, and none of these other things worked. So I'm a little more excited than you.
Well, let's put it this way. I'm excited. It's kind of like a contained excitement, but I love the idea of an easy to administer oral treatment that prevents hospitalization.
And also because it inhibits viral replication, you can imagine that like someone has a breakthrough infection and they won't be able to transmit if you treat them. It's like you come in, someone comes in, give them Tamiflu if they have mild flu, give them molnupiravir if they have mild COVID, and send them on their way.
Excellent.
Okay. This was a tough one. Young babies around unvaccinated people. Is that a risk to them? I don't know how to answer. Is that a tough one? What do you guys think?
We need a peds person here.
We can skip one if you want.
Monica, do you?
No, I was just saying you have tiny ones at home. They're such low risk. So I feel really comfortable around with the babies. I mean, we have to.
My thing is I rejoice at day 29 of life. I did that for my first two kids, because then if they get a fever, they don't need an LP.
Yeah, it's true. Yes, that's true. That's very
fever on day 28, day 29.
You don't want them to get any. Yeah, you don't want that.
Yeah.
It's another tough one. It's not really an ID. Well, it's kind of an ID question. The ethics of requiring visitors to hospital to be fully vaccinated. Do you guys have strong sentiments about this?
Here's my thing. Do you mind if I start, Monica?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. So I think that one thing that I think that we really need to, I get we want to reduce transmission. No doubt about that. But like, we need to start employing, rapid testing. I do think that if you have somebody who's been rapid tested, you have to have an infrastructure for that. I get that. But the things, at least that's a provision for somebody to keep. We did this for like a year in the pandemic, keeping people away from their family members. And it was awful. It was absolutely horrendous. And the other thing that, you know, the COVID vaccine is a medical intervention. It's not a club stamp, right? So I just find that people are in a way treating it like that, like, keep those unvaccinated people away from me. I don't want them in here, right? If this is about medical safety, a provision you can get that's reasonably effective is do a rapid test that day. If it's negative, that person could come in, right?
And wear a mask. Asymptomatic.
Right. And wear a mask, of course. Yeah.
No, but I mean, that's so like, I totally agree. I think that was one of the worst things we did. I will just say in a personal way that I had a very close person to me die 4 months before the pandemic. And we were all in the room the entire time. This idea that we kept people from being able to be with someone who's dying in their family just makes my mind explode. But we did do it. Wear a mask. Like, there's ways to keep safe. Like, we didn't have vaccines till recently. There are ways to keep everyone safe. And you're right, testing and masks. And so we should never have done this.
I've been quite vocal about this one, like as a palliative care doc and an ICU doc.
Yes. Yeah.
Fuck that.
Yeah.
Yes. French, but yes. No, you know, I just,
there's some things we did in this pandemic that people didn't write us up. This and the schools.
There's lines that are crossed. And I think as Monica put it, we know how to protect ourselves. We went 9 months in the pandemic with no vaccines. Okay. And like very little spread amongst healthcare providers.
Yes.
And so like, you know, let's all make sure to do the right thing. And once again, we're going to encourage everybody to get vaccinated. This is where if you're eligible, absolutely. But let's use a little bit of common sense here and some humanity, which has been, unfortunately, I feel like lost quite a bit during this pandemic. We hit the major questions here that I could see. Is there any parting thoughts for you guys in terms of any of the topics that we've covered or that are front of mind when it comes to the stage of the pandemic?
You know, one thing I want to say about this mixture of natural and vaccine-induced immunity and harder hit areas is that there was something in the United States, a modeling of where we were with seroprevalence before Delta. And I think we were around, it could have been up to 65%. That's an underestimate. Wow. And so that was before Delta. And so I think the one thing to remember about Delta is this is not a blessing or anything. It's not a happy thing, but it really did seek out a lot of unvaccinated adults and gave them immunity. And so it's almost like this blanket transmissible variant that gives a lot of people immunity. And I do think that we're getting from the epidemic stage to the endemic stage in many countries because of Delta. And, you know, I'm not even in, like you start, it's like, no one should get sick. So that's like a really important, like always, because you get blamed if you say that, but there's natural immunity, but there is. And so I don't think we're going to get another variant that's going to get, you know, that is going to be beyond Delta because it's so transmissible. And variants, they really, it's not smart of them to make people sicker. It's just not revolutionarily smart. It's smart to make a lot of copies of yourself. So I think that we are approaching endemicity in many places.
And the other thing that's interesting, I was reading an article the other day, is that, like, you know, right now in this stage of the way things are replicating, it makes sense. It's an evolutionary advantage to be much more transmissible, yes, right? Like Delta is just a monster, right? And we thought Alpha was a monster. Yeah. By the way, interesting fact, and I'm not sure if this is still true, but we've had more Alpha cases in Ontario, absolute, in terms of, like, compared to Delta.
In Ontario. Really?
I think you have a lot of immunity going into Delta.
I think so, too. In Ontario.
I would have never have guessed that, actually, just based on the hype, but that's fascinating.
And not to put down Delta, obviously, is a different beast. But interesting is what I was reading. So when you start to get down to endemicity, then the selection pressure on the virus is more, it's now more advantageous to become, to have some, you know, immune evasion. And I think we all agree that it's not a switch. It's going to be like a dimmer. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next couple of years. But I think that an honest evaluation of what happened, what we did well, what we didn't do well. And just the idea, like, I think that the temperature is quite high among, we didn't all agree on everything today. It was a good discussion about that. I think, like, getting back to that with discussion, because once we start to take the stuff off of Twitter, it'll be better.
Yeah, this was a good discussion, and people go crazy on Twitter.
Twitter's medieval, man. Like, I gotta say, like, my quality of life directly is impacted on how active I am on that bad boy. You know, I'm now on the, like, drop and pop, like, I'll drop and then leave it. I'm not even reading the comments. You know what I'm saying?
Isaac style, by the way. Isaac is, you know, stay, yeah, like, stay, I think, spray and walk away.
Yeah, Isaac, we're on some of us are on a chat group there that I've learned everything about COVID on, by the way. Just props to those, you know who you are, guys, but it's been such a great experience. The last thing I just want to say, if I can, is, I've said it before, and this is another thing I feel really passionate about, is, you know, how I've seen some of the unvaccinated being treated in hospital and that attitude that we're seeing towards them. And it's not a decision that I would want for my family, obviously, or my loved ones. But remember, these people are in a vulnerable situation. They're scared. They regret their decisions, you know. And then us giving them attitude and having this talk about whether we should be treating them the same is
terrible. It's
like, if we take a step back and think about what kind of message and discussion this is all about, it's atrocious. We got in this game to save lives, people. We got in this game to support people, and to have that level of like that lack of compassion in the most vulnerable time, to me, is disgusting. And we could do better. We need to do better. There's no excuses for this. And I will go to bat anytime for this. I don't care what people say on social media, whatever. We're not going to treat you differently based on your vaccine status or any other lifestyle choice you made. but we'll still encourage you, all those out there, to get vaccinated. So those are my parting words. I love this, guys. I was in between weeks in ICU, and I was like, oh man, I'm so gassed. But this rejuvenated me. This gave me hope again, Suman and Monica. It was just so great to have you guys on and to talk about these things again. And I just want to wholeheartedly thank you for this conversation. And I know it's going to benefit so many Canadians and listeners that are listening. So
this is the good thing about social media, is I met you both on there. So yes. Now I can be your friend later.
Quadju and I have never actually met in person.
Yeah, we've never met in person.
Oh, really?
We met on Twitter. What was it? It was like when we were like in residence, I think.
Back in the day, yeah.
And we've connected since, but we will meet
some friends.
I'm in Toronto next week, actually.
Okay, it's on.
Yeah, absolutely. So guys, thank you so much. Those on Twitter, Facebook, and on listening live, thanks so much for listening. Really appreciate you. Take care.